This is The Stateless Man for the pursuit of individual liberty beyond arbitrary borders, oppressive governments, and myths of national obligations. If you value liberty and are willing to migrate and vote with your feet, you've come to the right place.
Welcome back to another episode of The Stateless Man. We're pursuing liberty beyond borders, and it's my pleasure to be back with you. I'm broadcasting from Midlothian in Virginia, a place I've not been to before, and I'm on my way back from the International Students for Liberty Conference, which was in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. And I should mention our sponsor before I get into the topic of today, or topics. It is AMTG Solutions. That's amtgs.com for all your digital media and web development needs. If you want to get a website started up, check them out. They do great work. And so if you want to call in and engage with our guests, we have some amazing guests lined up. You can do so at 1-888-741-7472. That's 1-888-741-7472. If you're shy, you can also email me and I'll read your question out or comment at ferg@thestatelessman.com. That's ferg@thestatelessman.com. Now, many of you know, and I did mention this last week, that I was in Miami and just down in southeast Florida last week. And I attended a conference hosted by the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies, which also had speakers from the Language of Liberty Institute and the Cuba Corps. And the topic was basically the state of Cuba, which is a terrible and often a little bit scary situation, really, and what the indoctrination people are subject to there and how they can move on and become freer people or rid themselves of that once they get out. And we had exiles from spending a long period. We had one guest, Mario Martinez, from before the Cuban Revolution, who was actually a member of the Castro army until he decided to defect, and he fought in the Bay of Pigs invasion. So we had the pre-revolution people, and we had many new exiles. And it was just one of the most eye-opening events I've been to in a long time, really, because still many of us suffer from what one might call a benign view of Cuba. And I've almost done an article on this matter, which will be going up on the Stateless Man page, thestatelessman.com, about this event, the experiences there, including some interviews with the people who were fellow attendees. Now, I wanted to explore this further because it's not I learned a lot in this event, but it's not my area of specialty. And there are lots of key lessons to be taken away from this. So I've got the full hour open to this. I have one guest who is, let me get her bio here. Her name is Gisela Recare. I'm not sure how we best pronounce that in English, but Gisela, it's G-I-S-E-L-L-E, Recare, R-E-C-A-R-E-Y. And she is a representative of the Exterior Alliance for Democratic Cuba, or in Spanish, Representante en el Exterior de Alianza Democrática Cubana. And she was one of the fellow attendees and a recent exile from Cuba. So we're going to have her up first. And then after that, I have an academic from the Institute in Miami, Jose. And he will, let me see, Jose Azel. He spoke about the experience from before and after and what has happened. And he has just a lot to share as well. In the second hour, I have Trevor Tim, I should say. Now, he came to my attention through a recent article that I came across, which was about the approval of drones, surveillance drones across the United States, and they are just popping up everywhere. And this is of great concern to me and many other people. That image was shared 12 times, and he's from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He will explain what exactly this all means and whether we can do anything about it. In my view, it's just a terrible development. I don't want people overlooking us or, you know, spying on us basically from the air. And it seems like that's an unreasonable search, unconstitutional within the United States. And another reason why people should perhaps look elsewhere if they're in the United States, if they want to have a more private and peaceful life. Let's go to our guest who's on the line, Gisela Recare, and I hope I pronounced her last name correctly. Gisela, thanks so much for joining us on The Stateless Man. Gisela? Okay, well, I'm going to have to hold back on that until we get her online. I do see she is online on Skype, and I'll get back in touch with her during the break to see if I can find her. I'll just describe what I've been writing about this event, because it is revealing, and the attending this event, and I hope they can do it again. I've written an article for thestatelessman.com on the topic, and the title I gave it was Undoing Totalitarian Indoctrination, because if people are not aware of this fact, Cuba still is a totalitarian nation. Around 11 million people are subject to immense controls. And let me just give you a few thoughts from the opening paragraph, which I think set the scene and give you a good sense for what is going on over there. There's almost non-existent internet access. Less than 2% of people have home internet access. The internet access that most people have is strictly controlled and extremely expensive. People earn very meager salaries there and cannot afford to actually get online. The only people who really have any control are those who are very high up in the government of Cuba. So much for equality, as you can tell. Every block has a surveillance committee examining what you do, what you don't do, who you meet with. Any sort of meetings have to get some sort of approval. And one of the attendees at this conference in Cuba, he was a reporter, a journalist in Cuba, and he wrote, I guess, some criticism about the quality of the bread there. Not surprisingly, it's not a competitive environment, so you take what you get. And he received a 7-year jail term for being an accurate reporter. And that's just the sort of draconian existence that it goes on there. And I want these people, this is why I was so pleased to go to this event, because this sort of benign view of Cuba or sympathy for these dictators is just a terrible scenario, a terrible way of thinking that we should lay to rest. Okay, so the specialist that took, you know, sort of like captured my attention the most, his name was Mario Martinez. And if you go to thestatelessman.com, by the end of the day, I'm going to have an article up on this topic because it is so meaningful to me. I spoke to him for about 10 minutes discussing how he came to serve in the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was a failed attempt to overthrow Fidel Castro, and what life is like there. And he basically said, let me get the quote from him. He called it a total dictatorship, and quote, they control everything. They control where you go, what you eat, and who you talk to. Now I'm going to work to get our guest back, get our guest on out during the break. Stay with us, folks. I'm going to be getting, she'll be available for calls too. So this is, the Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
Your website is a major doorway to reach new clients. A dynamic web presence will generate you more leads and business. AMTG Solutions offers premium web design and digital media services for today's small businesses and entrepreneurs. Services are professional, affordable, and efficient. Visit their website at amtgs.com. Or email Tony at info@amtgs.com and let's get the ball rolling.
Welcome back to The Stateless Man. This is your host, Fergus Hodgson, broadcasting live from Midlothian in Virginia. And since we've not been able to get our planned guest on, I'm going to hold the fort down until the bottom of the hour and we get the next guest on. But I've got plenty to talk about and I'll be glad to take your calls. So I'm going to be discussing what happened at this Students for Liberty conference, which I was at just this past weekend. And if you were there as well, I mean, that would be great. You can call in 1-888-741-7472. Now, there were some just incredible speakers there, many inspirational people, and too many really for one event. I mean, it was just such a rapid event. That's to say that I could not get to speak with everybody I wanted to. And basically it was just a whole lot of saying hello, good to see you, got to get to another event. But if you are not familiar with Students for Liberty, I encourage you check them out, because they are just a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of information or support for those who are liberty-minded and want to network and advance the cause or find liberty in their own lives. Now, the producer just informed me that we do have Jose, the other guest from the Center for Cuban and Cuban American Studies. That's Jose Azel. He is an expert there, and he was also an exile from someone who fled Cuba prior to the revolution of the late 1950s. So he was a very young man at the time. And when I was in Miami recently, like I said, we got a briefing, and Jose was one of the speakers who just really caught my attention. So I'm glad we can get him on earlier than we planned, but I'm pleased to have him. Jose, welcome to The Stateless Man.
Thank you for having me, Fergus.
Right, Jose, I was really pleased to meet you I'm thinking about a week and a few days ago now, and you led the briefing for the members of the Language of Liberty Institute and CubaCorps speakers at the Liberty Camp in Miami now, at the University of Miami. One thing you noted, which I think many of us are not aware of, is that at one time you said Cuba was basically a star of the Caribbean or of Latin America, that it was really a prosperous or thriving place. Do you want to set the scene there? So what was it like, and what has happened in the intervening half century?
Well, in pre-Castro Cuba, that is to say, up to 1958, Cuba had actually become one of the most prosperous countries in Latin America, and in some cases in the world, by just about any objective metric we might want to look at, whether it was GDP per capita, number of hospital beds, automobiles, radio stations, newspapers, sure, and the like. So economically speaking, the country was quite prosperous. It was a relatively young nation. Cuba became really independent at the beginning of the century in 1902. So it had only been 50 years truly as a nation, an independent nation. So in that period of time, it was economically very prosperous. It was, however, politically inept, in the sense that we had dictatorships and coup d'etats and changes of government and that sort of thing.
Right. Okay. So it was a vulnerable place. One thing, though, that this is perhaps this one of the scariest parts of the story, is that it went from being this star of the Caribbean and one of the leading lights in the world, as you mentioned, to being very much not the case in a relatively short period of time. And do you want to tell people, how was that achieved? How did Cuba go from being a very unsavory place today, not necessarily the geography, but the people who are in control there? How do they manage that, given that people were accustomed to a better way of living?
Well, it's, January 1st, actually, 1959, yes, Fidel Castro takes over and very quickly begins introducing communist type of reforms, centrally planned economy, confiscates all private property, eliminates all private rights and the like. So it went from relatively a free market-oriented society with very little government intervention to a totalitarian regime where all private property was abolished, actually in 1968. Even the shoeshine stands were taken over by the government. So all private property was abolished, and a centrally planned totalitarian regime was put into place, which has resulted in the pauperization of the country. The country is today one of the poorest in the hemisphere. The average salary of Cubans today is somewhere between $17 and $20 per month. So it's one of the poorest countries in the area. And the regime remains next to North Korea. It is the country with the lowest level of economic freedoms in the world. North Korea ranks number one and Cuba ranks number two.
Well, but what I'm trying to get to, though, I mean, many people did just flee. They just said this is a lost cause. But how much resistance was there along the way?
Well, in 1959, when Fidel Castro takes over, we had a dictatorship. So at that time, it is fair to say that, you know, the vast majority of the Cuban population welcomed the revolution at that time, thinking that
right.
It was going to lead to elections in short order and the like. Of course, that
sure.
was not the case. It was a case of a betrayal revolution. The institutions, unfortunately, were not strong enough, and Castro was very quickly able, with the help of the Soviet Union, to really take over and destroy all of the institutions. The resistance fought really quite bravely for a number of years. We had the Bay of Pigs, but then there was the missile crisis in 1962, and things changed. There was a pact made between Kennedy and Khrushchev at the time that really sort of set the pace for what was to follow.
Mm. I want to examine, what exactly, what input the Russians did give, because what one fear that I have now in getting a better sense of what has been going on in Cuba is that this style of government, which is, it scares me. One fear that I have is that it is spreading to places like Venezuela, to Ecuador, and that other people, other sort of rogue rulers or officials around in other countries are basically seeking to emulate what has happened in Cuba. Would you comment on other people, you're sort of copying what Castro has done?
Well, copying to some degree. I mean, Cuba went the whole way. It went to a fully totalitarian regime, truly following, even more than the Soviet Union, following the Chinese Maoist model.
Sure.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, obviously the subsidies from the Soviet Union stopped. Now,
okay.
What we do see in Latin America today are places like Venezuela and elsewhere, where we see a socialist government intervention statist type of approach, together with a significant amount of anti-Americanism. But the state that you see in Latin America is probably part of the heritage from the Spanish colonization. But with the possible exception of Chile, most of Latin America today it really has a statist type of mentality. I actually wrote an article recently where I cite a survey where a vast number of the people in Latin America really believe that the government is the solution and that the government ought to do this and ought to do that.
Right.
So unfortunately, we have that kind of statism pretty much ingrained in the Latin American culture.
I'm gonna discuss that more, actually, because it's something that has intrigued me and confused me for a while. People, we're speaking with Jose Azell of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies. That's at the University of Miami. We caught up a few weeks ago, or a week and a half ago. Stay with us.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, your online radio resource about life abroad.
Excellent. This is The Stateless Man, pursuing liberty beyond borders. And during this hour, we are discussing a free Cuba and what that would mean. What is the state of Cuba right now? And I have an expert from the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies. His name is Jose Azell. And I caught up with him back in Miami just about a week or a week and a half ago. If you have questions for him, the number is 1-888-741-7472. You can also email me questions, Ferg at the Ferg at the Stateless Man com. I'm going to be publishing an article on this very topic today. I've been writing this one last night and this morning. The title is Undoing Totalitarian Indoctrination, because that's what it really is, that the state of Cuba is a very draconian right now, and I describe it as indoctrination without reservation, because the control of information is so tight. Now, Jose mentioned before the break, I asked him about whether other leaders in other nations such as Ecuador and Venezuela and Bolivia also comes to mind, are seeking to replicate tactics used by Castro, although perhaps not with as great a degree of severity, since Castro has even gone beyond the Russians to some degree in his tactics. He's been more aggressive. And Jose made the assertion, which is one that I've been sort of toing and froing with for a while, that Latin America is home to a more collectivist or socialist culture. And he said Chile is probably an exception in that regard. And I'm not really sure how to best define that, but many of us who are looking to move from North America and the Western world, I'm from New Zealand originally, we don't know the cultural differences necessarily, and we might be perplexed as to why there seemingly are these rogue dictators, or not necessarily dictators, but rogue leaders who play into class warfare so often throughout Latin America. And my sense is that it's not just a random occurrence. It's not just the people, that something is making this happen. Now, we're getting a little bit off track here, but if you want to make a comment about that, Jose, I'd really appreciate your insights into why that may be and how strong this sort of collectivist tendency may be within Latin America.
Well, it is something that we can speculate quite a bit. Obviously, the colonization of the North was entirely different by the Pilgrims in the United States, for example, than the Spaniards. Sure. In Latin America, that came to take back to Spain. There is another fascinating peculiarity that is a linguistic one, and I just wrote an article on this. It was published last week in the Miami Herald, where in Spanish, for example, we do not have we use reflective verbs that we do not use in English, and what that means is that we don't assume responsibility in Spanish as we do in English. If we drop a book in English, we would say, I dropped the book. Mm. In Spanish, it would be something like, the book fell by itself out of my hands. It was a fault of gravity, if you will. Now, to what degree that peculiarity of the language it has impacted, it's obviously unknown. But the fact is, however, that in survey after survey in Latin America, to questions like, which of the two statements comes closer to your opinion, the less government the better, or there are more things that the government should be doing, by far, in Latin America, the answer to there are more things the government should be doing exceeds by, 20 to 30 percentage points that same answer in the United States.
Wow.
And it's really, whether, again, it's a linguistic peculiarity that has induced this lack of acceptance of responsibility. And the reason I wrote that article, for example, was because In the English-speaking countries, and in Canada, we have had basically two constitutions. In the United States, we have had one constitution. In the Latin American countries, I think the Dominican Republic is leading the pack with 37 constitutions. Venezuela is 25 constitutions.
Whoa.
And it's always like every time there's a government, the blame is not on the act of governance and not on the policies, but the blame is placed on the Constitution. We've got to change the Constitution.
If I may hold you there, this article you wrote, is this the one, Government Regulations and Barking Dogs?
No, actually, that one's just last week. No, it's called Latin America's Wiki Constitutionalism.
Okay.
Wikipedia. Because they keep changing. That was the wiki constitutionalism.
Right. I will post this one on the Stateless Man page because that is very revealing. You say 37 in the Dominican Republic and something like 20-something in Venezuela. And we can go on forever discussing why that is the case, but I guess the key insight is that for us, it is the case. That's just a reality. Now,
exactly.
And we could discuss too why Chile is different, and I'm not sure whether you're very familiar with that instance, because many of us are looking at Chile as a place to flee to some regards. Now, I don't want to get too sidetracked, though. I mean, just give a quick comment on why you think Chile has been distinct in that regard.
Well, Chile, during the Pinochet regime, which was a dictatorship, actually Chile had elected a Marxist president, Salvador Allende, and then there was a coup d'etat by a military dictatorship, which did some terrible things, but it did something good. It actually imported out of the University of Chicago the so-called Chicago Boys, so very smart Chilean economists, free market-oriented economists that went to Chile and instituted revolutionary free market policies in terms of Latin American history. They did some incredible things. They actually took someone like Milton Friedman and took him to Chile, put him on national television, teaching the population about free market economics. And those reforms have brought about an incredible growth in Chile. And I would suspect that if the country continues along the path, and the country is now fully democratic,
right,
it will become measures a first world country within a decade or so, because their advance has been enormous, and it is the freest economy in Latin America today.
Just one piece of news on Chile: they are becoming the easiest nation to start a business in the world, that you can now incorporate online and in one day. And this is so that legacy is continuing to some degree. And many people are migrating this way. You know, that is great news. Yeah.
They also have a model of social security, privatized social security, that is really being copied by other countries around the world. It's an excellent model for a privatization of the social security system.
Right. I'll say that I've just posted, I'm going to get the article you're referring to. I could not find it while we were talking there, but you did put one article in the Miami Herald. You look to have a string of articles there, which is great, is the On Hispanic Voters Battling Spain's Legacy of Statism. And that one's up on the Stateless Man Facebook page. So, but folks, we're speaking with Jose Azell, an expert on Cuba and the period that has happened since the Cuban Revolution. If you want to call in, it's 1-888-741-7472, particularly if you're still sympathetic to them. So, stay with us. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
This is The Stateless Man, and I'm pleased to be with you, broadcasting live from Midlothian in Virginia. And I have Jose Azell from the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami. Really pleased to have him on. If you just Google him, and I'm going to paste up more articles from him. He has written a whole lot of great material, published in the Miami Herald in particular. And we're discussing how Chile is distinct. But I want to get back to Cuba, because that is in his area of specialty and what the topic was at the conference I attended just recently down in Miami. Now, let me pose this question to you, because this is something that continues on, that many people in New Zealand, the United States, Canada, many of us have this sort of almost like an idealistic view of Cuba, that it has these things like universal health care and universal education. And in fact, Michael Moore, that prominent documentarian went to Cuba just a few years ago when he was preparing his documentary Sicko, and he showed how this wonderful hospital. Now, Jose, and not only that, actually, so let's just respond to that. People, I saw a great interview with John Stossel and Michael Moore on this situation in Cuba. What is the state of medical treatment in Cuba? And is it just a myth that they have wonderful medical treatment?
Let me tell you the situation, the realities in terms of the hospitals for the Cuban people.
Yes.
There is no medicine. If you go to the hospital, you better take your own sheets and your own food, because there is no food in the hospital. There is no sheets or clean sheets. It is an absolute disaster. Now, there are hospitals for profit, in the Cuban sense, for foreigners that may go there, and those are well-equipped and well-supplied. But the hospitals for the people are an absolute disaster. And they said you have to take your food, you have to take your linen, you have to take your supplies, because nothing will be given in the hospital. And the state of medicine actually is quite a disaster right now. Cuba, in order to earn hard currency, sends many of its doctors and medical personnel overseas as a revenue-generating
sure.
enterprise. For example, in Venezuela, there are thousands of medical doctors that Cuba places in Venezuela, and Venezuela pays Cuba for their services. So there's actually quite a shortage of medical personnel in Cuba right now.
Right. That's the sense that I had for the situation. And I was just astounded that people would be so gullible as to think that just one visit to perhaps the best hospital or medical place in Cuba represented the whole country. But that was what was given off. And how do you, I mean, and there are also statistics such as life expectancy rates that give Cuba, I think it's 87 or either 87 or 77, 1 year less than the United States. And are these numbers just made up? I mean, what sort of life expectancy do you believe exists in Cuba?
Well, I wouldn't speculate about what the reality is, but Cuban statistics are notoriously misleading. Those of us, for example, that try to file Cuban economic statistics, they may publish a series for 2 or 3 years. They will
sure.
publish it for the next 5 years, and then they'll publish it again. They're just not reliable statistical information. Besides, Cuba still uses the old Soviet methodology. So instead of reporting like the rest of the world in terms of GDP and things like that, it will report in terms of global social product. And they define that in their own way, and they have their own metrics, which includes a lot of double counting and the like. So I would not rely on any statistics that are provided by the Cuban government.
Right. How are people getting out? I mean, we had a bunch of recent exiles in Cuba. How are they getting out at this time?
Well, there are basically two methods. The United States actually issues 20,000 visas to Cubans that want to leave the island per year, so that is the legal methodology. And of course, the people that leave either by boat or through a third country, or they defect. I think in today's newspaper, there's members of some sort of a athletic team that just defected, and that kind of a thing. So there is the current stream of people that are defecting or leaving by boat, or however they can leave the island. That's just what is really happening to a significant number of Cubans leaving the island every day.
Right. I mean, and is that a growing trend?
Well, there have been periods where has slowed down because the Cuban government has really made it very strict. But at the moment, the Cuban government is pretty much looking the other way, because what is actually happening, one of the most important sources of revenue for the Cuban government are the remittances from the expatriates, if you will, from the Cubans that are working outside of Cuba sending money to their family members. So at the moment, the Cuban government is sort of looking the other way and not really interfering much with people, you know, getting on a boat or on a makeshift vessel of some kind and leave the island. So it has increased. The diaspora is estimated at over 2 million, and Cuba's population is 11 million. So you're talking about, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of Cubans that live outside the island.
Sure. And during the briefing that you gave, you mentioned the way that growing up within this extremely controlled environment, I think you said that out of a population of around 10 or 11 million people, there is a private sector of 18,000 people, and that's an increase. And so, as you can tell, the ability for people to engage in any sort of direct transactions without going through government is just extremely limited, if almost non-existent. And that this changes the way people think, that they don't really know how to behave or wrap their heads around any other way of living. And you mentioned that when someone came to the United States, she didn't really understand a checkbook and was just writing out checks endlessly. And do you want to give us share another story or two as to how this way of thinking impacts someone when placed in an environment of relatively greater freedom?
Well, you know, one of the most terrible legacies of this now 53 years of totalitarian rule is that Cuba's civil society, as we understand the term civil society, has basically disappeared. Under Cuban law, for example, for more than three people to gather is against the law. So there is no such a thing as a civil society. There is, because it's been over half a century, there are very few people, only elderly people, that remember Republican Cuba and have even any notion of what a free market is and how a free market economy works. Obviously, there's a huge black market situation. So the disappearance of the values is perhaps the most terrible legacy. People have learned to lie, cheat, and steal as a matter of survival because everything belongs to the state. So it's not sort of thought as a bad thing if you steal the light bulb from the factory floor so you can sell it in the black market to survive that day. So when that happens over a period of time, you sort of lose a sense of values, and those that kind of behavior becomes ingrained in society. And that is what is going to be difficult to reverse in a post-Castro era. And it concerns us a great deal because, as we have seen in the former Soviet Union countries as well, corruption right. at all levels becomes endemic. And that's one of the issues that we will have to deal with.
Right. And what one of the recent exiles, Gisela Ricare, she made this strong statement. She said, kind of, enough of this political ideology and philosophy, whatever. We just want to live like Americans. And I appreciate her passion there. And she basically cut it down to that. Yeah, you don't need to confuse us. The fact is we are learning or we know that there's a different life on offer elsewhere, and that is causing dissatisfaction. How well do people in Cuba know about what is about life outside of the island?
Well, not very well. Obviously, the Cuban government controls all of the publication. There is no free TV or free newspapers or any such thing. Even internet penetration is probably one of the lowest in the world. It's estimated about 2%. Only 2% of the population has access to the internet, and those 2% are, of course, government officials. So there is no access to information of any kind. That said, you know, there are, you know, because some Cuban Americans travel back to the island, they take information, they tell them of their success stories. Sometimes, you know, disk drives are smuggled into the island with books or information. So people are beginning to learn a little bit about the world outside. and the lies that they have been told for the last half century. So there is that kind of an awakening there, but it's limited, obviously, because there's no mass way to distribute that information.
Right. Well, we are coming up on the end of the hour, and I want to say that, Jose, you know, I'm very impressed by the articles that you've put out, and I'm going to look for this one. If you want to just hold on the line before as we go to the break, so we can get down the headline of the article you referred to about Latin American constitutions, that would be great. But if you want to learn more about the work that he's involved with, you can go to the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies. That's www.6.miami.edu.iccas. So stay with us. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
From China's Great Wall to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, this is the Overseas Radio Network.
This is The Stateless Man, brought to you by AMTG Solutions. That's amtgs.com for your digital media and web development needs. Now, I just finished that great interview with Jose Azell of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami. And I posted one of his articles, which is of particular interest to people who wanted to get a better sense for, you could say, cultural inclinations of people with Latin or Spanish backgrounds, particularly because many of us look to Latin America as a haven or somewhere to go to expatriate, including the base for the Overseas Radio Network, which is down in Costa Rica. And this author, Jose Azell, he was born in Cuba and is a writer down there in Miami. And he has another article coming about how the constitutions within Latin America just change all the time and what that means. But it's only out in Spanish right now, so I'll post that once I get the English version. But the one other article that I did post, which is extremely well written, and I'm just very impressed by the scholarship of this man. It's titled On Hispanic Voters, Battling Spain's Legacy of Statism. And he notes that basically people who describe themselves as Hispanic, I don't like giving labels to people, but if they self-describe, I'll let them keep it, that there are more and more of them in the United States, and people are seeking to identify their distinctiveness or what their preference is. And there is a distinction with immigration because naturally many of them are newer to the country, so they're probably more open to immigrants. But there's much more than that at play. And Jose notes that this goes back to a heritage from Spain and just a different understanding of the role of government and different from the founding fathers of the United States. He said, quote, thus classical liberalism or libertarianism in the contemporary American coinage does not come naturally to Hispanics. So he brings up an American national election study, and the question was this. Which of these two statements comes closer to your opinion? One, the less government, the better. Or two, there are more things the government should be doing. And 47% of what he calls the white non-Hispanic population responded with the less government, the better. So about half of the people wanted less government and strongly so. In contrast, only 18% of Hispanics responded similarly. That's a 30 percentage point disparity. That's an enormous disparity. Now, similarly, in a question regarding preferences of free market versus government solutions, the white non-Hispanics opted for the free market can handle economic problems, whereas 83.3% of Hispanics favored government involvement. So this is a concern for many people who are trying to flee to a more classical liberal haven. The fact is that the background within Latin America, he believes, dates back to the Spanish conquest and Spanish culture, which is not in support of classical liberalism and a limited role of government. Now, let me see what else he's got written down here. He says that this is one of the important points relating to Cuba. So this collectivist and statist political tendencies are even more markedly present in societies that have lived for extended extended periods of time under totalitarian rule, naturally people become accustomed to such ways of living. For the Cuban people in particular, more than half a century under a totalitarian regime and under the constant bombardment of Marxist-Leninist rhetoric, it's left a legacy of a civil society unprepared for the responsibilities demanded of a citizenry and a liberal democracy in a competitive market economy. Now, there's a lot more great material in this article. He mentions how Hugo Chavez's, quote, socialism for the 21st century is just one example of this sort of ideological vulnerability playing out. And I was just in touch with people from Venezuela at the latest conference, which I'm going to discuss next. And they were saying that it's like a war zone down there. And they said, just do not go to Venezuela, Fergus, that you already stand out enough. So they will see you from a mile away. So yeah, again, I'm very pleased that Jose was able to come on, and his article's on the Stateless Man page. It's got great content there, very well written, and I will also have my own article coming out about this Liberty Camp and the Cuban exiles by the end of the day. Now, I did just come from the Students for Liberty conference in Washington, D.C. Now, I am just a big fan of the Students for Liberty. If you haven't checked them out, you should do so. Their website is just studentsforliberty.org. And the International Students for Liberty Conference, the sixth annual event, drew 1,400 students from around the world. And I was just glad to be among that group. I'm no longer a student and actually have some sort of critical comments about higher education in general. But this event, there were just so many people there. It was so inspirational. I highly encourage people to consider it. And I'm excited to say that Students for Liberty is just booming in numbers. That just, 5 years ago or back when they had their first one, they had, I think, about 80 students come, and mostly just America, just from the United States. But now they're from all over Africa, South America, Europe. Everybody is coming to this event. And the organization itself is no longer an American organization, that they're setting up chapters all around the world. So if you haven't looked into them and you are wanting to connect with other young people who are advocates of liberty, it's simply studentsforliberty.org. And there are so many groups involved, and they have different events throughout the year, not just this one annual event. So I will actually post that as well on the Stateless Man page. Now, at this event, as I mentioned, there were very many thought-provoking people, and I just want to share a few thoughts that came to me while I was there. In particular, I will say that I just like what the guests that they invite. They don't get politicians. Man, I'm sick of hearing them talk. They get successful entrepreneurs, businessmen that you can look up to, and women who you can look up to. And this year's keynote for the Friday evening and alumnus of the year was John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods Market. What an incredible company. And a man that you can look up to, who said he's had success beyond his wildest dreams. Now, we're approaching the break now. But if you want to call and discuss if you were at the Students for Liberty conference, if you have any comments on Cuba, you're welcome to do so. It's 1-888-741-7472. I'll be glad to take your calls and to chat about what I experienced there and many of the other issues. There were so many issues that were controversial and great speakers. But we've got to go to a break, so stay with us. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Stateless Man. I'm pleased to be with you. This is your host, Fergus Hodgson. And I want to note that after the next break, we're going to have Trevor Tim of the Electronic Frontier Foundation describing what is going on with surveillance drones in the United States. This is a very concerning trend. And a recent article on their website, EFF.org, they noted that there are more than 80 groups across the United States that now have approval to use surveillance drones, which is just eerie to think about, that people are flying all over observing what you're up to. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. Until we get there, though, I want to continue describing what was going on at the Students for Liberty, International Students for Liberty Conference of 2013, just this past weekend. And The keynote speaker that I wanted to refer to most is John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods Market. If you haven't tried them out or haven't been to that store, you should if you're, I'm not sure where it is now. It's definitely in Canada and the United States, and I think maybe Hong Kong or other parts of the world, but it is, it seems, at least in North America, it seems to be everywhere. And they provide, as the name says, whole foods or natural foods, and they have an incredible selection. It's just very successful. Now, John Mackey described his new idea, which is conscious capitalism, and the website is consciouscapitalism.org. He has published a book on the matter, and he is around touring and promoting it. And yes, the site is consciouscapitalism.org. And his actual presentation itself was not that exciting. The greater component of it, or the first half of it, was just him going through why he believes capitalism is better and what that exactly means. But then in the second half, he discussed how we would actually apply that if we were going to be entrepreneurs. And then he discussed his personal life story a little bit. And that's what caught my attention the most. Now, this is what I wanted to touch upon, just an inspiring personal story. There were two queues for questions, and I queued up but did not get to ask him a question. And someone hogged the questions for about, I'm not sure how many minutes, but with three questions. And then, so yeah, a few of us got to ask, but one young man did ask John Mackey, why Whole Foods? How did you get started? And John Mackey said, that's a great question to finish up on. He said, I was 19 years old, I guess back in the 1960s. I'm not sure when this would have been. And I was reading this book, part of a philosophy course, and he asked the audience, has anyone read the book? He mentioned the title, and someone said yes. And he said, I pity you. And he pitied him because he said, when I was 19, I was sitting there reading this book, and I was thinking, this book is just going in circles. What a load of garbage, and I can hardly follow it. Why am I doing this? And he said, I had this epiphany. You know what? I'm never going to read a book again that I don't want to read. And he said the next day he quit that course. He dropped out of it. And he said, you know what? I'm never going to take a course I don't want to take again. And he said that he dropped out of the course. And he said he took something like 120 course credits, I'm not sure, a few years worth of actual classes. And he said, well, I never got a degree. I didn't graduate because I took just courses that I wanted to. I didn't actually follow any sort of class or major structure. But he said, I did get an enjoyable education. I learned plenty. And I went on to get a job working at a co-op, at a, you know, a natural foods co-op. And I just want to firstly say that I admire the courage of a man to just say, look, I'm not going to play along with the silliness of learning junk I don't want to know and junk that I don't need. And if you haven't looked into my thoughts on higher education, please consider reading my review of the book, Lies, Damned Lies in Higher Education, or College Admissions, I'm sorry. The title is Demystifying the Cult of Higher Education on thestatelessman.com, because I'm very I just think it's a fact that most higher education is a total waste of time and money, and people should get on with enjoying their lives and doing something meaningful. So then John Mackey said, well, after that, I went to work at a natural foods co-op. And I got a girlfriend there, and I decided I liked this retail business. I liked the idea of serving the customer, of giving them what they want. This is where actually he may even kind of go against his true principles to some degree, in that he may not believe in certain products, but he's still going to sell them. If you want to buy them, he will sell them. And one example would be, quote, fair trade products, which people who study economics know that this is economic gibberish. It's very poorly defined, if defined at all. It's simply sort of circular reasoning that it is fair trade because someone has defined it as fair trade, rather than saying actually what that means. Regardless, I doubt if it has any positive economic impact other than making people feel good. Regardless, he sells those goods in his stores because people want them. And so he said, when he was working in retail, just as I guess someone stocking the shelves and working the till, he said he decided he wanted to open his own store, and he spoke with his girlfriend, and she was into the idea, and he went around and begged relatives, and they lent him $45,000 to get his first store started. And he lived on about $200 a year, $200 a month for 2 years, so just scraping by, barely making a living. And he said he worked really long days. But he said because he was driven by a passion, it was worth it. He really enjoyed the work. And he said, it's maybe four decades now later, he said that it has been successful beyond his wildest dreams. That Whole Foods has just gone, done more than he could ever wanted, he could have envisioned. And now he doesn't even take a salary from Whole Foods. He just does it because he loves his job. He doesn't take any stock options or anything like that. I mean, I imagine he still owns the majority of the company, but he just gets satisfaction out of spreading the Whole Foods organization. And it's more than just a company selling food. And this realization is part of behind his conscious capitalism idea or book. And I'm going to expand upon this point, what he means by conscious capitalism. He said that there's a problem with the way we define business or free enterprise, that people like me or other people who want to make money through business, people define us by that aspect, that business people, they're out to make money. But he said, look, do we say that about teachers or doctors or lawyers or whatever? He said, we say, what do you do? We don't say they make money. We say they do something. They provide a service, a good, whatever it may be. And he'd like to see us defining our business ventures in that way too. And he said, that's sort of like an elevated level of capitalism, that if you want to be successful, he said, in a more modern environment, you should make a target that is not just making money. And he said making money wasn't necessarily his first goal, but it eventually happened and he has been successful. But he said, look at companies like Southwest Airlines in the United States. Their goal was to make air travel accessible to the majority of the population. And he said, they achieved that. And in doing so, they became profitable as well. And Southwest shook up the oligopoly, which I guess still exists up in Canada to a large degree, of very elevated priced tickets and limited competition. And he said that has been very successful. He said Google is another example where they say they want to bring organized and readily accessible information to the world. And they're doing that and they're extremely successful in that endeavor. So he said, yes, rather than just basing or defining your venture in terms of making money, define your ventures in terms of an actual goal, a goal which will be satisfying to you and will be enriching to people who engage with you as well. And this is where a more controversial point came out. He said that he does not believe that self-interest, and you might say this, the Randian tradition or the objectivist tradition, is sufficient or adequate as a moral basis for capitalism. And he did make actually some dismissive remarks about Ayn Rand. And I know people who listen to the show, some of them are objectivists or Ayn Rand fans, and I've had people on from the Atlas Society. This is one area where I thought he was a little bit confused, and I plan to sort of open this up for discussion on the Stateless Man Facebook page. I got the Atlas Society's sort of intellectual officer to give a rebuttal. Now, so I'm gonna post that this discussion of whether self-interest is a good basis or legitimate basis for capitalism and whether we should look to move beyond that. But after the break, we're going to be going to an interview regarding the drones in the United States and Trevor Tim. So I'm really looking forward to that. You're not going to want to miss out, and I've already posted the article of that, but stay with us. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, your online radio resource about life abroad.
Welcome back to The Stateless Man. It's my pleasure to be with you. And we are in the final half hour of the show, and I've got a great guest lined up. This has been a particular interest to me, and I'll say it's relevant to one of the shows that I listen to all the time. It is Liberty in Exile, libertyinexile.com. A friend of mine, Yale Osofsky, does that show, and he is very much into tracking, you could say, the surveillance of police state, not just in the United States, but all around the world. But right now, I am referring to a group called the Electronic, let me bring this one up here, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I have Trevor Tim from that organization. Recently, his organization put out an article which chronicled or listed all of the approvals for surveillance drones or aerial or drones around the United States. And you can see this map on the Stateless Man page. FAA, the title of the article is FAA releases new drone list. Is your town on the map? Question mark. The website is EFF.org. And the author of that article is Jennifer Lynch, but she passed me on to one of her colleagues, Trevor Tim. And yeah, there are, this is concerning. The article identifies 81 approvals for public entities who've got these approvals. And that's through to October 2012. So no doubt there have been more since then. And they're just dotting up all over the country, including a bunch in Virginia and one in North Carolina, where I am right, well, where I usually base my show from. So, Trevor Tim, let me give you a bit of his bio. He is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He specializes in surveillance, free speech, and government transparency issues. Before joining the EFF, Trevor helped the longtime general counsel of the New York Times, James Goodale, write a book on the First Amendment. He has also worked for the ACLU and at the New Yorker. He went to Northeastern University, which is just by Boston University, where I went to school. And his Twitter is at Trevor Tim, which I will post on the Stateless Man page. Now, so Trevor, I'm not sure where I'm speaking to you from or where you're speaking from, but I'm really pleased to have you on the show. Welcome to the Stateless Man.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm coming from San Francisco.
Right. Actually, a great place to be. I've got relatives out there and I've been out a few times. So now, let me see if that's on the map there. California's got a whole bunch of these drone dots, actually. Mm-hmm. And one looks like it is over San Francisco, and I guess another one maybe Sacramento, the capital. This article that your organization released, they had to do a public information request, right? A FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request to get it. So you were the first organization to actually have these organizations revealed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, actually is quite transparent when it comes to manned aircraft. So if you're actually flying an aircraft yourself, they release the information about what type of aircraft it is, who has the license, and what they're using it for. But for some reason, drones, they decided to keep all this information secret. So we actually had to sue them under the Freedom of Information Act last January. And finally, they responded last April with an initial list of drone authorizations that they had handed out. And they have been slowly releasing them to us every few months. And so we're actually the first organization to get them. Unfortunately, like you said in the intro, that the list they give us is about 2 or 3 months behind. So that, there's 80 authorizations on the list. That number is almost certainly higher now. And we'd like to see them, release this stuff real time to the public, on their website instead of kind of holding it up, using this lawsuit as an excuse to, keep this information a secret for longer.
Slow down. What's this lawsuit you're referring to?
Well, we sued them under the Freedom of Information Act to find out, how much or who they're giving, drone authorizations to and what the authorizations allow police departments to do, and just as much data as they have on drone authorizations as they could possibly hand out.
Sure. And how would that be delaying the process? How would that be sort of giving them an excuse not to reveal such information?
Well, I mean, thankfully it is forcing them to release information, but when other people have been requesting information from them, sometimes they've said there's an ongoing lawsuit, and then they have to release information through us first. And so we would like to see them release it, in real time on their website instead of with a 2 or 3 month delay.
Right. And I'll say one thing, actually. We should perhaps define what a drone is, because many of us hear that it's been referred to these drone attacks in the Middle East in particular, which are also deplorable. And we're not talking about drones in terms of drone strikes. We're talking about just drones for surveillance, correct?
Right. So, when everybody thinks about drones, they think about the Predator drones that are flying over Afghanistan and Pakistan with missiles attached. For the most part, we're not talking about that type of drone. Obviously, there will be no missiles on these drones in the U.S., There are Predator drones that fly on the U.S. border. They don't have missiles attached either, but they do do surveillance for border issues like smuggling drugs and potential illegal immigrants. The Department of Homeland Security has 10 of these drones. They actually lend them out to local police stations. But what we're mostly talking about are smaller drones, you know, like 3 or 4 feet long, and that are sometimes referred to as quadcopters. They have 4 rotating copters, and they're much smaller than the Predator drones we're used to, but they do have powerful capabilities. I mean, these drones, you know, besides having high-definition cameras, can be attached with infrared or heat sensors that can literally see through walls. They can be attached to facial recognition technology, radar technology that can intercept your phone calls or text messages or lock onto the GPS in your cell phone in your pocket. So they have huge capabilities, and basically they take all of the surveillance, invasive surveillance tools that the police have used and put them all in one vehicle that can fly in the air. You know, in a few years, they potentially may be able to fly for hours or days at a time.
What do you say to people who just say, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you've got nothing to hide?
Yeah, I mean, that's usually the argument that governments make, especially authoritarian ones. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. But, of course, that's not actually true with anybody. I mean, if I was to ask you right now, if you have nothing to hide, why don't you just publish all of your emails on your blog? Or why don't you give me your password to let me do the same? And obviously you recoil in horror if somebody asked you that and be like, no, of course not. You know, I have privacy. And luckily in this country, we were blessed with the Fourth Amendment, which gives us a right to reasonable expectation of privacy. And it's not on us to prove that we need privacy. The burden is on the government to prove that they can invade our privacy to investigate a crime. And so that's the way we want to keep it. And we want to make sure that the police have safeguards in place to make sure that they're not going around violating people's rights whenever they want.
Aren't they already doing that, though? I mean, I've written about the TSA and how I feel molested by them every time I go through. And are we not already subject to great surveillance through, I mean, I lose track. There's just so much news on this topic that I'm glad I've got an expert like you. But are we not already subject to a great deal of surveillance against our will?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the last decade, surveillance has really ramped up in the U.S. You know, besides this problem with drones that we may have coming up, you know, email surveillance, electronic surveillance, and cell phone surveillance has never been higher. You know, Google and Twitter released transparency reports every year. They just released one, each of them, last month, and it showed that surveillance is, at least with those companies, is at an all-time high. A lot of times the government is getting information at a much lower threshold than they used to. When the police want to read your physical letters or listen to your phone calls, they need to go to a judge and get a warrant, which requires probable cause that a crime has been committed. But a lot of times with email, especially older emails that are over 6 months old, the government doesn't think that they need a warrant and that they can just use a subpoena, which basically is just a piece of paper with a prosecutor or a clerk's signature on it, and it doesn't have to go through a judge, and it doesn't have to be have probable cause. It basically just basically the prosecutor has to say they want this information. And you know, with our electronic rights, they've kind of been eroded to the point where our physical rights, we now have more physical rights than electronic rights. You know, the same thing can be said
Trevor, we're coming up on the break, so just, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, but I really appreciate the content you're giving us. If you want to speak with Trevor, give him a call. It's 1-888-741-7472. And I'm looking forward to the next segment with him, so stay with us. This is The Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, your online radio resource about life abroad.
Welcome back to The Stateless Man, and we are talking drones all across the United States, and I have Trevor Tim, an expert, to just explain these from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, defending your rights in the digital world is the tagline they have for their organization. And before the break, I was asking him, you know, why would we want to oppose this? I mean, it seems self-explanatory to me. But I thought the analogy he gave was great, that sure, you may not be doing anything illegal, but we still want privacy. You know, we don't want to just have everyone read through our emails. Not that there's anything unsavory there, but just privacy in and of itself is something that we appreciate. And this digital world we're entering is generating all sorts of, you could say, not necessarily ambiguous scenarios, but scenarios where people in government who don't care about your privacy and want to control you are gladly sort of like jumping in there and sort of ignoring restrictions that might otherwise exist against those sort of interventions into your privacy. Now, the article which I posted on the Stateless Man page is FAA releases new drone list, is your town on the map? And that includes a list of a whole bunch of organizations that have these surveillance drones in the United States that, as Trevor described, are not that big. They're just maybe five feet long, something like that. But they have, within this little package, is a lot of power to check the GPS on your phone, to see through walls, lots of things, and it's not terribly savory. And one thing strange about it is that some of the organizations that have these surveillance drones are just community colleges. Why on earth, let me bring Trevor back on, why on earth would community colleges want to have surveillance drones?
Well, I think right now, number one, drones are a booming industry, and so a lot of schools are starting pilot programs to teach people how to fly them. But there's also, you know, there's also purposes that you can use drones for that aren't malicious or potentially dangerous to people's privacy, you know. I think a lot of universities are using them for research. I mean, NASA uses drones to fly them into hurricanes and to study global warming. I mean, they can be used to fight forest fires or survey natural disaster areas or drop medical supplies into hard-to-reach areas. So it's not that, you know, this technology is all bad. It's like a lot of technology. There could be good uses and there could be bad uses. And we just want to make sure that there are safeguards in place to prevent the bad uses while still allowing the good uses to happen.
Right. I see. That is a good point that, sure, they could be used for just research purposes. I don't know how you would stop people from then stepping over the mark and actually looking into people's lives.
Right, that's the problem. I think, yeah, there's a fine line, and I think it's going to get even worse. Right now, only public agencies can get them. So what we're focusing on is police agencies. You know, there's a few dozen that have licenses in the U.S. right now, and there's been a huge backlash, I think, with the public. You know, a lot of privacy issues these days don't get a lot of coverage, and people know that their privacy may be invaded, but they don't seem to care because they can't feel it. But with drones, you know, they can imagine seeing a drone and feeling a drone over their head. And so in 15 states right now, there is drone legislation that would restrict their use in the name of privacy. And that, you know, in Seattle just recently, the mayor ordered the police to dismantle their drone program because of public protests. You know, here in California, just down the street in the from EFF in Alameda County, the sheriff wants two drones and faced a huge protest when he brought it to a public hearing yesterday. So people really care about the issue, but the question is, you know, what's going to happen in the future? With police right now, it seems that people are really want to prevent them from using them. But in 2015, you know, there's going to the FAA will allow commercial uses for drones. So there may be, you know, paparazzi drones, or there may be, you know, companies that are flying drones industrially over cities and just fucking up huge amounts of information and publishing them on the internet. So there's all sorts of problems that, you know, I don't even think that we've necessarily thought about that, you know, in 2 or 3 years could become a reality. And I think at this point it's time for people to start imagining the different scenarios and how we could potentially protect our privacy when those times actually come to pass.
There are lots of questions that flow from that. One that comes to mind is that I know that in the online world, many people are aware of this problem, even though, like you said, we can't really feel or understand, perhaps, online surveillance. But organizations like this mega.co.nz new sort of file sharing website, which is all encrypted and even even the site owners can't access or see your content. People are trying to use those to get around the surveillance. Is technology arising in the same regard to sort of counteract surveillance drones that people are, you know, maybe building with materials that cannot just be seen through, or they are putting things on their phones which mean the GPS cannot be accessed from a remote location? What can people do in terms of actual technology to counteract this?
Well, actually, there is an artist in New York who just came out with an anti-drone hoodie, which you can actually put on and kind of hide the heat coming off of your body, so potentially drones with infrared sensors couldn't sense that you were there.
Whoa.
You know, you could see this type of technology being used, like, on whole buildings, for example. But, you know, I don't think we're at the point where we need technology to combat drone surveillance. I think that protests at this point, unlike, you know, how people care about email and location privacy, the drones seem to really hit a chord, and that these protests have been actually very successful, and that state legislatures are really now fast-tracking bills that could potentially pass very soon that would restrict drone surveillance. And I think we're on the verge of a real victory here if people really put their minds to it and actually tell their local public officials how they feel about this issue. And they can really get somewhere.
Mm. You are a U.S.-based organization, but are you examining this use of drones in other countries as well?
Well, I mean, it's hard to avoid the use of U.S. military drones these days, especially given all the controversy surrounding, you know, their legal justification for potentially killing American citizens, and also just the general secrecy around the program. I mean, we have a secrecy problem in this country to the point where virtually everything in the foreign policy and national security realm is classified. And it's really preventing the American public from really finding out what their government is doing under their name. But beyond the U.S., you know, there's over 70 countries now that have some type of drone, whether it's surveillance drone or armed drone. And those numbers are literally growing every week. I mean, the drone industry right now is well over $5 billion a year, and they expect to continue to grow by the billions as each country that...
slow down there. I want to just clarify that point. You said that other countries are acquiring drones at a rapid clip. Is there a source or an article on your site that explains that or breaks that down?
Not on our site. You can go to New York Times. They talk. They have a few articles about you know, the amount of the proliferation of drones across the world. At EFF only talk about drones in the U.S. Because we're a U.S.-based organization. But, you know, there are, like China has over 20 types of drones. They're now flying surveillance drones over disputed area, disputed island with Japan. Japan, I think, wants to counter with more drones as well. Korea has drones that they watch North Korea with. All of the European Union now wants to have drones. The police really want to start using surveillance drones as well. You know, they have a much bigger history of, you know, having this type of surveillance where cameras are everywhere. And so it may be harder to stop in the UK. But, you know, a variety of police organizations and militaries across the world really think that this is the new go-to technology. So, you know, as far as who's using drones, I guess the better question would be who's not using drones.
Whoa. Okay. Who is not using drones? Other than some counties or districts in the United States that you say have nullified them to some degree, but are there any other nations that have just simply made an across the board no, we're not going to touch them?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, you know, I guess there's a difference between these countries wanting to use them for surveillance purposes or wanting to use them, you know, surveillance purposes in the sense of policing their domestic population or for military purposes. But I don't. I think the strongest, ironically, the strongest anti-drone movement as far as surveillance goes is now in the U.S.
That is interesting. Yeah, I would agree. I would imagine that to be the case. Even though you said the information is spotty around how much drone attack, how many drone attacks or the drone usage by the United States outside the United States borders. Do you foresee a time when, and we know that one U.S. citizen along with some of his friends at a barbecue in Yemen suffered death at the hands of one of these drone attacks. Do you foresee a time when these drones will actually be armed within the U.S. borders?
Hopefully we'll never reach that point. I mean, the scary part about the legal rationale the Obama administration used for targeting American citizens overseas is that it wouldn't necessarily restrict them from doing it in the U.S. if they actually wanted to. Now, I mean, there's a whole other question about whether that is actually legal.
I want to respond to that because people say, well, is there legal justification? I'm going, you're killing an innocent child. I don't care what legalese, you know, arguments people can ponder up. This is just wrong. So it is a concern, but as you say, right now it seems that such loose justifications could be transferred to basically within the borders. I'm sorry I interrupted there, but just I'm very concerned that getting out of hand. Yeah.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of people are worried about that. And the problem is that they've been doing these drone strikes in secrecy, and so the public really had no idea what they were doing until this legal rationale leaked. And so, it really, I think, scared a lot of people to see the actual words on a page explaining how potentially easily they could do this. Now, as far as armed drones in the U.S., hopefully that would never happen. A lot of these drone bills actually ban armed drones outright, despite the fact that actually the manufacturers of these domestic drones freely admit that they're manufactured to potentially attach what they call less lethal weapons, which are like tasers and rubber bullets and beanbag guns.
I'm going to end it up there. I mean, I really appreciate your time, and like, your organization is doing great work, so thanks for coming on the show, okay?
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Right on. So folks, this is, has been another great week for the Stateless Man. I'm really glad to be broadcasting with the Overseas Radio Network, and I want to see you all back next week. And don't hesitate to follow the updates on thestatelessman.com and the Facebook page. So I'll leave it there. This is the Stateless Man on the Overseas Radio Network.
From China's Great Wall to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, this is the Overseas Radio Network.